I rode with old Jeb Stuart and his band of Southern horse. There never were no Yankees who could beat us force to force. No, they never did defeat us, but we never could evade their dirty foreign politics and cowardly blockade.
Ah, those dirty foreign politics. Welcome back, folks, to the Rebel Madman Radio here on Republic Broadcasting Network. And I am just absolutely, you know, ecstatic, I guess would be kind of a word, to have my guest today, Karen Quinones. And her knowledge, folks, is just absolutely off the charts. Compared, if we compare it with most of the people in New York, she's probably, at least ahead of a million people. So, Karen, would you continue, please, lady?
Yes. Well, Mike asked me about Abraham Yates. And Abraham Yates, he's one of these great stories. I tell a story about someone similar on my Revolutionary War tour. And, you know, he's one of these guys who is not a New York aristocrat. You know, he's a self-made guy. You know, he's an artisan. He lives up around Albany. And, of course, they're all up there, the Schuyler family and the Van Rensselaer family and the Livingstons with all their money. And I'm just, like, looking at this now. I wasn't aware of this, but Philip Schuyler called him a crude cobbler, a late cobbler of laws and old shoes, which is really great, because when we get up to the 1750s and leading into the Revolutionary War, we have a kind of revolution going on in New York, and that's the revolution of the self-made men versus the landed gentry. So we have all this landed gentry in New York, but now we have all these annoying guys who've made their own money. You know, Alexander McDougall, Abraham Yates. We have all these guys, they're radicals. They go on to form the committees of correspondence, right? We have the committees of correspondence who are going to unite everybody against the Stamp Act. Shocking. The colonies didn't even talk to each other. And suddenly this committee of correspondence comes along and the 13 colonies are united against England. Then Yates is going to go on to serve in the New York Provincial Congress, which is, this is incredible. The Provincial Congress met from 75 to 77. While we actually had a royal government. So they are the rebel government against the royal governor, William Tryon. And all kinds of radicals are serving in this provincial Congress during this time. You know, New York is going back and forth with different power, right? The loyalists are in power, the rebels are in power, and it's just kind of chaos. And the provincial Congress was full of all of these wonderful, you know, self-made radicals that simply would not bow down to, you know, Delancey power or landed gentry power or any of this stuff. And they just could not be controlled. And so it's great to see that, you know, Yates was a member of this. And I see he also later, this is interesting, was against the Jay Treaty, right? He's against the Jay Treaty
the
later.
Treaty? Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Was he one of the guys who said, damn John Jay, stay up all night and damn everyone who won't damn John Jay?
Well, you know, we do know, and you might know more about this than I do, that John Jay was taken out by a brick. Someone threw a brick as he was riding along in a carriage. Someone threw a brick and actually hit him and kind of took him out of action as far as the Federalist papers were concerned after his initial beginning. And there was a professor at the University of Houston, a history professor, who called that brick a missile from God.
Whoa. You know, I know they were hanging effigies of John Jay.
Oh, yes.
The Jay Treaty was incredibly unpopular here.
Oh, and if I may, let me share a little bit with you about Abraham Yates. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. During the 1780s, Abraham Yates became increasingly troubled by what he suspected was a conscious effort to subvert the fruits of the Revolution to the ambitions of a privileged few in order to establish a more powerful central government. Then in his 60s, Abraham Yates began to express in writing his opposition to the emerging forces of nationalism and monarchism. anarchism. And so in 1786, he published a polemical monograph entitled Political Papers, addressed to the advocates of a congressional revenue in the state of New York. He also wrote a series of essays in opposition to a stronger central government under the pseudonym Cato, Sidney, and a Rough Hewer, H-E-W-E-R. These newspaper articles, published over a period from 1783 to 1792, were perhaps the most widely read expositions of the Anti-Federalist point of view. During that time, Yeats resurrected and revised his earlier histories of Albany, Rensselaerwyck, and colonial New York, underscoring and intensifying his claims of a historical conspiracy to deprive the ordinary people of their essential human rights. These histories served as a background for a major polemical tract that Yeats wrote in 1789 on the movement for the United States Constitution with the adoption of a Bill of Rights. Yeats ended his writing efforts, and those essays remained unpublished, unfortunately. Got any idea where someone might find those, Karen?
No, but you know, I'm going to look for them, and I'm going to ask some people here if they might know where I can find them.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Man, if I could put my hands on those, I would be like a kid with a brand new tricycle at Christmas.
So I can only guess that, you know, Yeats is allied with the other, you know, anti-federalists, and the people he's talking about there subverting, you know, the government to make it a government of the powerful over everyone else, is that he's talking about the Hamiltonian faction in New York,
Not only that, but John Jay, who said the people who own this country ought to run it.
Right. So that would be, you know, Hamilton J. Morris, the Bank of New York guys.
Yes, very definitely.
Bank of New York, another one to talk about there, right? So they go right ahead and establish their own bank to help themselves out, just as the anti-federalists warned, which was the reason, of course, the Virginians opposed assumption of the debt later, because Hamilton wanted a federal bank. And they're like, hey, look at your bank in New York, which is a bank of aristocrats for the betterment of aristocrats. We're not going to let you create a federal bank to do that. You're going to end up like the Bank of England, and the government will be like the parliament. You know, so no federal banking. You know, you just want to recreate your New York bank on a federal level.
Well, bringing it back to the Civil War era, let's not forget that under the Freedmen's Bureau, they set up a Freedmen's Bank early on, where that soldiers in the Union Army, black soldiers, could put part of their money into a savings account, where other people throughout the southern colonies and even into the north could put their money into a savings account for future use. And then the people who ran the Freedmen's Bank stole all the money.
Oh, my goodness. And there was a lot of that went on.
Yes, it was estimated that when they stole this money, well, just to show you how shrewd these bankers were, one of the first things they did when they saw that they had loaned each other all of the money, everything that was there, they had loaned to each other as directors of the bank. Then they saw that it was about to crumble, and they didn't want themselves to be the people holding the incriminating evidence. So who did they hire to be the head of the Freedmen's Bank, completely him not knowing anything about the fact it was about to collapse? Did anyone know that would happen to be Frederick Douglass?
Wow, really?
Yes. So they brought Frederick Douglass in as a black man to be the scapegoat for the fall of the Freedmen's Bank. Yes.
I'm trying to look while you're speaking. I used to know what this number was, and I can't find it, of how much the New York banks loaned Abraham Lincoln for the war.
Oh, I don't have. I would be interested in that if you can find it. I would be very much interested in that.
You know, I used to know the number and how much they made on interest.
Oh, it was incredible, because at the beginning of the Civil War, the national debt was something like $78 million. By the time the war was over, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 billion. And, of course, all of this money loaned. And let's not forget that, you know, somewhere around 1862, after Lincoln had, you know, he just started an army for 90 days because those poor Southerners were not going to be able to stand up to the might.
Yes.
So he only brought him in for 90 days. But then suddenly, after he's getting the Union Army's getting their butt kicked all over the place, especially in the Shenandoah Valley by Stonewall Jackson, he goes to his Secretary of Treasury, Salmon P. Chase, and he tells Mr. Chase, we need to borrow some money here. We can't keep this going. So Chase contacts the International Banking Cabal. And the International Banking Cabal says, look, we'll loan you all of the money you want at 40% interest. And Lincoln said, no, we can't do that, to the Secretary of Treasury. So then he issues what is called the greenback.
Right.
And the greenback is doing fine. And the international bankers find out that they can't compete with that. And that's about to destroy them. So they send Salmon P. Chase somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 to be able to influence enough members of Congress to do away with the greenbacks, which they did with the Currency Act of 1862 and 1863. But prior to that, they used what is called the Hazard Circular to get all of this started. Are you familiar with the Hazard Circular, Karen?
Just a bit.
Okay, well, I will be happy to send that to you if you would like to have it.
I'm really interested in Chase and, you know, what he was up to. I know that besides those war bonds you mentioned, he also was getting money from New York at a reasonably high interest rate, too, to enrich the New York banker, friends of his.
Yes, out of the old Hamilton Bank. You know, and those people who were in charge of that. Are you familiar? I know you're familiar with the Schuylers. Are you familiar with John Barker Church?
Oh, Angelica's. What do I want? Rascal of a husband.
Yes, that is being very polite.
That she had to elope to marry.
Right. And the ironic thing about this is where you try to put pieces together. John Barker Church, that's his name. He came out of England under a different name altogether, John Carter. And he comes out and he is allegedly fleeing debtor's prison in New England. In England. He gets to America, becomes affiliated with the Schuyler family, and is allegedly a financier of the war. How do you escape debtor's prison and finance a war, Karen?
Well, I guess if you have the right connections. And he spent most of the war, I think, he and his wife, in England.
Well,
that's another big error in the Hamilton mythology, is that, you know, Angelica met Hamilton when he was courting her sister, but I don't believe that Angelica met Hamilton until after the war, because she and Church were in England during the war, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then let's not forget that after the government is started under the new Constitution, John Barker Church goes back to England. The guy who was fleeing debtor's prison goes back to England, becomes affiliated with the Bank of England. And then he and Hamilton combine to buy up the IOUs of various people in order to be able to use those as a basis for taxation.
Yeah, that was a big scheme, buying up all of the IOUs, especially after the Revolutionary War.
Right.
A lot of big New Yorkers made their money that way.
Oh, Hamilton sent several people south to buy up any of these IOUs that they could find. And normally they bought them up at like, 10 cents on the dollar. In today's phraseology, of course, back then it wasn't a dollar. But right. If we use the approximation, about 10 cents on the dollar, then they get them back to New York, where they're in the hands of the wealthy elite, which they just purchased at, bottom prices. And then they come up with the act by Hamilton to pay back all of these debts at full face value in specie.
Wow. Hamilton's father-in-law went bankrupt in one of those schemes.
Philip Schuyler. That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but then, there's so much here, Karen, and I just can't thank you enough for being here with us. But there are so many tangents, that we could take, so many things to explore. But I want you to continue, if you would, please, ma'am, because you're just a wealth of information.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the other antics going on in New York during the Civil War.
Because please do.
New York is always a fun city. So when New Yorkers figure out, or at least the power in New York figures out, well, there's lots of money to be made on war, right? Because somebody's going to have to build those railroads, those rail cars. Somebody has to make uniforms. I bet you know who made those Union uniforms. Brooks Brothers. That's how they started their business, making Union uniforms. And they used inferior fabric so that they were shoddy. They said the Union troops were poorly shod because of the crappy fabric, and that's where the word shoddy came from, and then they were pressured into using a better quality fabric. The factories were running virtually 24 hours a day, making everything needed for the military, right? The shipyards were making ships. They made the Monitor over in Brooklyn, the ironclad ship. What else were they making? They were making money, too, right? Betting on the stock market. And remember, J.P. Morgan Jr. is here now. J.P. Morgan's here. He's a young man. He's got his money. And J.P. Morgan is heavily invested in gold because our friends in the South are still on the gold standard, right? So Morgan goes out and has a telegraph installed in his office. And he's paying guys to go out and follow these battles and then run to the nearest telegraph and telegraph the results of the battles back to him. They said that Morgan often got the battle results before the newspapers and sometimes the White House, and then he would hedge his gold depending on who won the battles, right? So if the South won, he'd buy more gold. If they lost, he'd sell some gold. And they're all trading on this gold. Well, the South was doing very well, beating the North for quite a while. And so at that time, commodities were still traded on the New York Stock Exchange, some of them anyway, and gold was one of them. And there's a great story about the way the gold traders, when they would hear that the South won a battle, would stand up on the floor of the exchange and sing Dixie in honor of the gold price going up. And that Lincoln, made a call to the, stock exchange, and he was just furious that they were doing all this. And he says something like, oh, somebody should take a gun and blast all their heads off. He was just went on this rampage. So the New York Stock Exchange threw out the gold traders, and they went down the street and opened a gold exchange instead. So that's some of the money-making antics. I mean, New York, when we grow up in New York, we learn, New York is all moral and the whole story is the story to end slavery. But the truth is, New York was still trading in the forbidden cotton trade during the war. They just weren't shipping the cotton in and out of New York anymore. Or they were for a while until Lincoln blockaded the port and they couldn't. But they were still trading cotton out of southern ports. They were still dealing with slaves and after there was no more importation of slaves, New Yorkers were handling the sale and purchase of slaves within America, during that time. So they were still making money on all of this stuff. They were making money on armaments. They were making money on supplies. And, they were just making money on the war, lending money to Lincoln to fight the war. So New York's interest in the war really is a financial one. And then guess what? New York figures out, well, hey, if they're going to go down and destroy the South, well, somebody's got to rebuild that, right? They're going to need railroads. They're going to need infrastructure, houses.
you know, we're gonna go rebuild the South and we're gonna make money there too. So, you know, for New York, it's my personal idea that New York's role in the war is just all simply about money. And there's nothing moral or saving the Constitution or preserving the Union or anything like that. And Fernando Wood, really, and some of the Tammany guys were the only honest guys who said, look, this war doesn't have anything to do with us in New York. We don't want to have anything to do with this. You know, we're just going to leave. You know, we'll be a separate city. You guys fight your war and we'll see you when it's done. You know, I think they were the most honest guys here.
Well, Karen, here's a question to go along with that. And I've asked this question and you hardly ever get an answer. If the people of the North, as we would call the North, if the people who wanted to stay in the Union were so supportive of the war, why did Abraham Lincoln have to invade three border states, New York, during the war?
Right, because they largely weren't. You know, I can't say that there was an idea at that time that the Constitution was permanent. Because remember, when the Constitution was ratified, right, like what did ratification mean? You know, ratification meant you took the Constitution back to your home state, your state legislature debated and voted, and then you submitted a ratification document, right? And the document said, you know, I ratify the United States Constitution and had any other type of claims in it. For instance, the New York ratification document is the one I know, so I can say it was, you know, issued by Governor George Clinton, who was an anti-federalist. And it says we ratify the Constitution based on the condition that amendments will be submitted. So New York based contingent on those amendments. And nowhere, I don't think, does it ever say this is forever. You know, that we ratify this Constitution forever. I think, doesn't Texas even say they can leave?
Well, Karen, here's the thing I want to bring up, and thank you for initiating the thought. But most people are totally unaware that three states put into their ratification documents the right to leave the Union if the Union ever overreached and harmed the people in the states. And those three states were Rhode Island, and New York.
Oh, well, so that sounds like Rhode Island. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, the Rogue Island, as they were called.
Oh, yeah.
So if they put into their provision that they could secede if the government ever overstepped its boundaries, and they put it in there, and then we look at Article 4, Clause 2, which says, or 3-2, which says that, no, 4-2, which says that all states have the same privileges and immunities. So if New York, Rhode Island, and Virginia were admitted to the Union with the provision they could leave, it didn't every state have the right to leave if the federal government overstepped its boundaries?
I'd say so. And you know, another thing we don't learn in school, which people are shocked when I tell them, is we can return to the election of 1800 and the filthy election of 1800 and Thomas Jefferson's election as president, which for various complicated reasons enraged New England to such a degree that New England threatened to secede from the Union.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And what was Jefferson's response?
Yes.
Well, you know, you're welcome to go. We wish you the best, and we look forward to engaging in commerce with you.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Wouldn't that sort of say, you know, that that was an understanding? Because in 1801, that was still the constitutional generation, you know, the people who supposedly understood it best. And New England says, we're gone. And Jefferson says, see ya.
That's a great point, Karen. That is absolutely fantastic. It was still during the Revolutionary era. And Thomas Jefferson, in his first inaugural address, addressed the point that several New England states wanted to leave the Union because he was president And he said, in effect, go if you must, but let's remain friends. And, you know, we'll look forward to our continued commerce, our interchange, you know, our buying and selling. We'll look forward to all those things. So he didn't say, hey, if you, you know, if you leave the Union, I'm going to invade and kill you and rape your women and kill all your animals. He didn't say that. And also, you know, I think it's, you know, most people are unaware of this, that it really wasn't a battle, as everyone has said, between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. The final battle was between Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
They were the ones with the most votes, and Adams was a distant third.
Yeah, he was.
He was out
because of Hamilton's meddling.
Yes,
we could do a whole hour on the election of 1800.
Oh yes, I'd love to do that sometime if you're available, young lady.
Of course, I wanted to mention, we were talking about Jefferson being so gentlemanly about New England's threat. We fast forward now to 1861, 1862, and who screamed the loudest that the Southern states, you know, couldn't secede because of the Lincoln presidency, but New England?
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, and that is South Carolina. You can't do that. You can't do that. He's your president. Well, like, what? Didn't you just threaten to do that like 61 years ago?
Well, they did it again. Let's not forget that. They did it again during the War of 1812.
That's right.
The New England states had a meeting called the Hartford Convention where they voted to secede because of the War of 1812. So they tried it not once, but twice.
And then were the loudest against the Southern
and
states.
What does the word hypocrite have any meaning here?
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking of this wonderful book. I have to look it up because I don't know the author's full name. I bet you know this book. The Yankee Problem, an American Dilemma by Clyde N. Wilson.
Clyde Wilson, yes.
Who wonderfully talks about that New England Puritanism and the way it still exists in America today, and who really the descendants of that Puritanism are and have been. And it's a great book. I recommend it to New Yorkers all the time, and they get really mad at me. We see this like Puritanism even today, you know, this idea that, you know, one set of colleges, one set of graduates, one set of intellectuals reigns supreme over anyone else. And anyone who disagrees obviously is of a lesser morality, lesser intellect, lesser learning, or whatever. And that today is, you know, I agree with him that this is a holdover from that era of Puritanism, which really marched us right into the Civil War. You know, these unbending Puritans in New England, you know, who had to have their way, who, you know, incited the press. A good example, I was speaking to someone, one of my Southern, we'll get to this after the break, the caning of Senator Sumner.
Oh, yes. Yes, that will be a great point to go to. And I really look forward to you and I dissecting the 1800 election, because that's one of my favorites.
Wow.
So I look forward to that. So, lady, if you will, let me know when you have some free time on a Saturday afternoon, and we will schedule that for the future.
Okay,
and
we'll be
here comes the music.
Template.
We'll be back on the other side. Oh, that'll be great. Thank you. Back on the other side, folks.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Extend your life. Everyone around me seems to get sick but me. My brother got the flu twice, my mother was down with some sort of fever, people at work were taking sick days off, and others were just plain tired and run down. And me? Well, I just keep feeling great all the time with Extendivite. My grandfather used to talk about the power of garlic and other herbs he took that kept him healthy. I'm lucky. Extendivite was just what I needed to keep me healthy, and Extendivite is all natural. Extendivite was designed for the heart but does so much more by keeping me healthy all the time. I'll take Extendivite forever. Get your 2-month supply for only $69.95 plus shipping and handling. My name is Rick, and you can be like me just by calling 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on Long-Term Food Storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because Big Tech, Big Pharma, and Big Brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we, the people, are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
Yankee letter said the baby coming any day. And if you planned on getting out alive, best be on our way. Our tattered gray was torn between if we should run or fight. But our southern pride swelled up inside as we dug in for the night. Then I heard a rider calling, they're coming down the road. And the fiery flash of 20-pounders started to explode. Tried our best to stop them, our efforts were in vain. In the distance you could hear the sound of Dixie's last refrain. They're burning Georgia down, those devils dressed in blue. They suit the higher ground.
Balsam Range, my fellow Confederates from North Carolina, what a fantastic bluegrass group, Burning Georgia Down. And that is one of the things that I truly love about that group, of many others. But anyway, let's get back to Karen. And Karen, I'm going to, I want you to open up, and then I want to introduce you to one of your biggest fans.
Okay, great. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about, since we're talking about this period, the caning of Charles Sumner, the senator from Massachusetts, who was caned in the Senate in 1856. Now, of course, when I went to school, I learned that Sumner was this wonderful man, you know, an abolitionist, and he gave this beautiful speech, and this maniac slaveholder from the South, you know, tore into his office and beat this poor old man with a cane. And then some time went by, and a friend of mine from Texas said to me, "Did you ever read Charles Sumner's speech?" And I was like, I said, "Gee, no, I think I'll go read it." Because, you know, if you're an intelligent person, isn't that what you want to do? You want to go read it. So I read the speech, and oh my gosh, no wonder, no wonder, you know, he got whacked over the head. So then I started looking a little bit more into Charles Sumner, you know, who was a, you know, rabid abolitionist from Massachusetts. And when I say rabid, I say these are the guys who were, you know, carrying on this dialogue that, oh, we have to march to the South and kill every slave owner, you know, really, you know, riotous and incendiary stuff. And of course, the newspapers were supporting him. So he gave this speech about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, right? And it's called the crime against Kansas, you know, that this is terrible because, you know, Kansas is going to be a slave and all of that. And in it, he really insulted the Senator Butler, as well as Douglas, Stephen Douglas.
Yes.
And it's really inflammatory and nasty. And he compares one of them, I think it's Douglas, to Don Quixote. And
yes.
I think Butler is his sidekick, Sancho Panza. And slavery is his favorite whore. My husband's sitting in his chair laughing. is his favorite whore. I mean, it is just awful stuff. So his nephew, you know, so Butler's nephew picks up a cane. He's so angry, he goes and he whacks Sumner over the head a couple times with his cane. But, you know,
not enough.
When you read what these guys were saying, you know, it's really insulting, inflammatory stuff. And that's really not, in my opinion, you know, worthy of a senator to say about other senators. It's really bad stuff. But, sure. You know, we forget that New England, the Yankees up there, were doing this constantly throughout the 1850s, this constant agitation. You know, they're the people who incited John Brown, and they paid for him. And when John Brown was captured, the guys who paid for him fled the country and went to Europe.
Yes, I wonder why. Well, before we move too much farther on, Karen, I want you to meet, I think, one of your biggest admirers, an old friend of mine from Colorado, a gentleman by the name of Steve. Steve, are you with us? And say hello to Karen.
Yes, I am.
Hi,
yeah,
Steve.
It's a pleasure.
Likewise.
I when you were on the first time, you suggested to go watch that series Copper.
Yes.
And I did, and it was really enlightening. And in that series, they talked a lot about how a few of the rich families had a scheme to burn down the Five Points area.
Right, to profit from it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Builds back
I
better.
I was wondering if you found anything in your out anything about it in your searches.
Well, you know, I don't know specifically, but it would not at all surprise me. There was a sanitary commission report on the Five Points, and it was Cooper, the guy who started Cooper Union, who actually warned all the people who owned those buildings, look, you know, these buildings have to go. This is going to be terrible. The conditions here are bad. There's going to be some sort of epidemic. You know, you really have to start, you know, tearing down these buildings and building better housing for people, you know, which was his intent. But it wouldn't surprise me, you know, if they did have a plan to burn it themselves, and then they could, of course, rebuild it themselves and charge more money for the dwellings. But they were making money, you know, on all the people living in there in those really horrific, horrific conditions. So, you know, you get these wealthy families, they show them in Copper, which, by the way, couldn't get made in America, which tells you something about the series there. They show how these families really controlled all this wealth, right? They owned the factories that all of these immigrants and poor people were working in, where they made money.
and off of them. And then they also owned the hovels they were living in, where they made money on them on the rent. And they also largely owned, you know, the groggeries where they were going on their one day off in order to drink and try to enjoy themselves, and the gambling parlors. And you see in there, they also own the brothels, right? They also own the brothels. So they're really making money all the way around on the poor. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's true, that they had a plan to burn the whole thing down and then, you know, profit from rebuilding it. You know, it wouldn't be a surprising thing.
The reason that I was asking, I'll tell you, I was born and raised in Chicago. I left when I was 18, went west. But I studied Chicago history in school. And in 1864... 9 railroad companies formed the Union Stockyards, which were the largest stockyards in the entire world. And a lot of the Irish and Italians from New York went to Chicago because that was the gateway to the West. And there was a lot of jobs that were opening there. And I believe that a lot of the Irish were leaving to get away from Lincoln's war. And it was always strange to me, because the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 was where it was like the Five Points area, and that's what all burnt down.
Wow!
And then they did it again in 1874 on the south side of Chicago, which removed all the black people from that area.
Yeah, you know, there's still always rumors here around New York City whenever a block of buildings mysteriously catches fire and burns, and then the property is sold to a developer and some new, like, luxury high rise is built in its place. So I think there's probably some history.
A lot of the Irish and Italians left New York and went to Chicago in the early 1865 because of the stockyards and because everything was opening up, just to get away from what was happening in New York.
I'm sure. I mean, you know, my family's Italian, and went to Scranton. Many of them went to Scranton and further upstate New York because of the expansion of the railroads. They were helping to build railroads, build roads, or work in the coal mines. And, you know, we see lots of Italian migration from New York City coming in the 1880s and 1890s, going through Chicago and to places like Michigan and Minnesota, Wisconsin, you know, fanning out in that direction. Because honestly, you know, coming to New York in the late 19th century, New York was a really crowded, dirty, anarchy sort of place. You know, there was a lot of gang warfare. There was a lot of filth, a lot of disease. People were packed in a lot of exploitation. So it would make sense to me. You know, my family didn't stay in New York. They just came, landed, and continued west. I'm sure many, many families did that. You know, took one look at New York and said, oh no, I'm not going to stay here. Or they may have already had contacts that moved further west and said, look, we're out here in this, you know, place called Illinois, or we're in this place called Michigan, and it's really nice. So, you know, get to New York, work for a while, get your train tickets, and come here instead.
Well, I think that that's why Chicago was always Democratic, where the rest of the state was Republican.
It could be, you know, the Irish and the Italians at that time were Catholics, and the Catholics tended to be Democrats.
Yes,
and still
many times
are here
over
in New York.
Well, Steve, buddy, thank you for your call. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you got to talk with Karen. I know you
thank
were.
Thank you.
Karen, I'm going to give Steve away. Last night on the class that I did for Steve and the folks in Colorado, he was singing your praises for quite a while. So I just, you know, I'm giving him away here.
Thank you so much.
Your knowledge is amazing, and I want to thank you. I'd like to thank Michael, because between the two of you, you're showing us true history instead of all the lies that we've been told in school. I'm the same age as Michael.
Heaven forbid I'm going to wait for the helicopter over my house now.
All right. Hey, Steve, thank you, buddy. Take care of Colorado for me, will you?
You bet, and you, Michael.
Let's talk to David in California. David, how are you, sir?
Hey, greetings. And you're worried about helicopters. We've got screaming jets overhead today. The Blue Angels are in town. So if all of a sudden you hear a massive noise, it's probably because of them. You know, I was wondering, as you're talking about obscure history, if your guest has heard about the Hazard letter?
He asked
Hazard
me.
Circular? Yes, I brought that up. Yes, I did. Go ahead, Karen. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I have heard of it, but I have not read it, so Mike is going to send it to me.
Yeah, it's as I understand it, if I remember right, it's a Lord Hazard, and he basically is trying to prevent the outbreak of actual shooting. The Hazard letter is designed to teach people how to make a company store instead of having slavery, and the company store, the employees think they're free, and they have to go to the, you know, pay rent at the company. They buy their beer like you're describing in the last segment. The company store, people can be tricked into thinking they're free, and if they're actually slaves, they know they're trapped. But if they think they're free, you can make more money, and you won't have to have bullets flying. And so that's basically what the Hazard letter is about, you called it the Hazard circular. I suppose that's possible, too. But I see that the modern politics are really just trying to get the company store back. If you look at the Republican Party, were started as abolitionists. They were the ones that were trying to stop slavery. And the people in the South, the whites in the South that weren't, small cobblers, small merchants, small this or that, they were swamped. There was no way they could keep up with making a product that on the other side of the county, somebody with 10,000 slaves could outbeat, you know, your shoe manufacturing 100 ways to Sunday and do it all with slaves. So it's no different than having all of the shoes America buys coming from China, where they're getting 7 cents an hour. So it's the company store is the big trick. And the Hazard letter and whether or not the Republicans today, they're not advocates they're not anti-slavery. They're just trying to get the company store again. They bought the Republican name, basically. It's a bait-and-switch party now. And so the corporate store is big on the list for what the Republicans are trying to do right now.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you would talk about that model, because one of the debates that was going on, you know, in New York, I mentioned that upstate New York, so that's like everything north of New York City, were anti-federalists, and down here they were federalists. During the Civil War, up there they were mostly against the war as well, and down here against the war. One of the things that was being debated was, you know, Hamilton's idea of finance. Hamilton liked the idea of somebody owning a corporation, and he started one of New York's first corporations. It was called the Bank of New York, its first bank to be incorporated after the American Revolution. And his view was that people would then work for these wealthy company owners, where when you got to the anti-federalists, the guys upstate, they were, oh, no, that's just a form of slavery. You know, people need to work for themselves. That what brought us prosperity leading to the Revolutionary War and brought us these great men who could fight the war were men who worked for themselves, you know, with a couple of employees and maybe an apprentice who then went on to become a master themselves. So here during that time, we were having that argument, you know, over what's better for a whole lot of people to work for one guy, like a feudal system, really, or for all of these individuals to work for themselves. And of course, the anti-federals felt that the engine of prosperity would be all of these individuals working for themselves, and that that would be freedom.
Well, and it is. The difficulty is in the currency that gets used. And, you know, throughout the centuries, it's been recognized that there are currency speculators. And when you start dealing with, you know, if you're selling corn, if you're selling beans or mining ore or whatever, you can hold it in your hand and see the quality. In money, you don't necessarily know if this money has been used by, you know, organized crime or the so-called rich guy that you're trying to borrow money from is really just all this prostitution money and they're trying to help you buy a Cadillac or something like that. No, they, you have a company store, Ralph Nader has given a bunch of speeches about this. He describes the 13 colonies, and there were more actually than 13, but the 13 that agreed to go were 13 corporations chartered by the king. And they had 13 different types of money. There was Georgia money, there was New Jersey money. And yeah, and so the value of that money was still by whoever had the title to the corporation. And so if they made good products, then Delaware money might be good. But if they were, you know, crap industry, then Delaware money, who wants to buy that? Who wants to do business with them? Now, if the country is, you know, divided up, so to speak, by individual merchants, but they agree to use a common currency, they hypothetically want an honest currency instead of something that's designed by a tyrant and run by big boss. And the issue of the currency and whether it's an honest one is and has always been part of this issue. And nowadays, I don't know if you've heard, but Saudi Arabians about 6 months or a year ago were saying that they no longer want to use U.S. dollars when they sell oil.
Now, many countries.
But what are they going to use? Are they going to use Russian money for the base, where it's really just a bunch of rich guys?
Yeah, David, if I could, there is quite a bit of proof out there that we went to war against Iraq back in the early 90s because Saddam Hussein had dropped the dollar as the number one unit and had gone to the euro for his oil in
that.
Iraq. And that,
yes,
so that,
and what
has been speculated.
And what did Mr. Gaddafi of Libya propose?
Yeah,
exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah, and it was an issue about whether or not people with enough natural resources, and in the case of Gaddafi in Libya, I'm not sure if they are the best quality, like jet fuel quality oil. It's called sweet crude. And it has very little impurities in it. And so it's a very easy one to refine, and you can do a lot of really nice clean oil as opposed to dirty stuff. And so I think Saddam Hussein also had decent quality oil over there, but Kuwait was trying to do slant drilling into his pool?
David, if... Let me add something here to that. I'm sorry for interrupting, but let's not forget that Saddam Hussein went to the United States government when the slant drilling was occurring from Kuwait. He talked to Assistant Secretary of State.
April
I'm trying
Glaspie.
To think of his name. His name was...
April Glaspie.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, thank you. He went to him and said, we're not going to put up with this. And he said... And so the Assistant Secretary of State says, do what you have to do. So Saddam did, and then we went to war with him.
Right. Yeah, it was a great setup.
Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. And much less did the U.S. somewhat authorize the Kuwaitis to do it in the first place. Just to provoke Saddam Hussein. But, yeah, it's been ugly, you know, and that's why these wars, and, you know, I'm a baby boomer, so I remember the Vietnam War was really supposed to be all the oil offshore of Vietnam. They had discovered all this oil offshore, I don't know, 10 or 15 years earlier, and it was basically a pool of oil that went all the way down to Australia from Vietnam.
Well,
and that so too, they
that's yeah, Dave. And don't forget the rubber tree plantations also that Michelin wanted.
Oh yeah,
in Vietnam.
Yeah, much less rubber down in Brazil and whatnot. Yeah, no, these right. wars have really been
corporate wars.
As the American Revolution was.
Yeah, exactly. But guys, if I may, we're about to run out of time here. As much as I would love for this to continue, David, feel free to call in again. We really would like to have you. You have a wealth of knowledge. Really enjoy your input. But we're just about to run out of time, and I just want to take time to thank Karen. Thank you, David. Thank you so much. And I want to take the time to thank Karen properly for joining us today. And let's get together, Karen, and let's figure out another time where we can join up to do the election of 1800. Or, you know, I'm sure there will be a subject come up in the meantime. Folks, in the meantime,
pleasure.
Please. Thank you, lady. And folks, in the meantime, please don't forget to support RBN. And if you would, go to my Substack, michaelgatti.substack.com. I'm putting out a lot of source documents, a lot of information. So I would ask you to do that if you can and if you will. And then in the meantime, I think we're rapidly closing towards the end here. Karen, I want to give you the last word, please, lady.
Well, thank you all for having me again, and it's my pleasure to help everyone see the way history repeats itself again and again so that hopefully we can, you know, be aware of what's going on around us today.
Oh, very much so. And I think it was, you know, a couple of quotes there where you talk about how history repeats itself. Wasn't it, I was trying to think exactly, Napoleon, I think it was, who said history does not repeat itself, but it just rhymes.
It sure does. And David's remarks, the Revolutionary War was a corporate war as well.
Yes.
We'll talk about that. England was trying to control resources, currency, everything.
Exactly. And that is so much. And I really look forward to us getting into further discussions on this. And we're about to be out of time. Karen, just say goodbye to everyone for us and thank them for being here and tell them you'll be back.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. And for those of you who get in touch with me, thank you as well. I will be back with Mike another time. Thanks for joining us and thanks for the questions and keep reading your history.
Oh, thank you. Well, here's the music, folks. Folks, thank you so much for tuning into RBN. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Steve. And thank you, Mr. Producer. Thanks, everyone. God bless. Have a wonderful week.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
Support those that support the network. Support Dixie Republic at DixieRepublic.com. Email ProudSouthern123@gmail.com and let them know that RBN sent you.
listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.